I picked 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John because I realized late last fall when I was beginning to think about this, I just hadn't read 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John in a while. And so I read them and I thought, yeah, this is good. There's some things here that I think are timely for our day. And so we'll just dive in and take a look at that. But before we get to the question that I had you vote on, another question. What would you say are the biggest challenges facing Christianity in our day? I probably should have warned you about that one, so you could think about it. What are the biggest challenges? Oh, it did. That's right. It was on the, thank you. What do you think are the biggest challenges facing Christianity in our day?
Social media.
Interesting you should suggest say that.
Technology?
Saying one thing and doing another. Okay.
Christian behavior.
Yeah, yeah. We're not going to get far from this, are we? No. Anyone else want to venture in? Biggest issues. Interestingly, I don't think I've heard an issue yet.
Christianity mixed with politics.
Yeah. Yeah, an interesting dilemma for us, absolutely. You've pretty much all identified some of the underneath stuff. You know, so many times we have arguments or discussions on this level and go back and forth on what we think about X, Y, and Z, but really our disagreements are under here. Some of our assumptions that lead us to our disagreements, and I think those are actually where the bigger questions are. I'll give you my opinions on that here in a minute. So is Christianity more a matter of belief or behavior? And if we'd weigh those out, you're very solidly in the middle. I assume that means you think that they are both equally important and that you weren't just avoiding the question. Right, that they're both, which is true, right? The answer to this question is yes, right? Yeah, the answer is yes. Now, looking at that, it looks like you are slightly weighted as a group towards the belief side. This is where Lynette's, some of her AP statistics tricks would come in, but I can just look at that and see it's weighted a little bit to the left, to the belief side. There's a few more Bibles or hymnals over on this side than there are on that side, but pretty solidly you're recognizing that both. Here's the thing, for John, in his letters, John is clearly weighted toward the behavior side. Now, John is not the only New Testament voice on this. And he comes out there because he is writing to a congregation that is experiencing a particular challenge. He has a reason for emphasizing the behavior side of the equation. There might be other New Testament places in the New Testament we could look where the belief side is emphasized because that was the more relevant answer in that situation. But for John, in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, he is very heavily weighted toward Christianity being a matter of behavior. Well,
all right, now I worked all day on this. Here we go.
From my study, that is every reference in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John that you could put into one camp or the other. Your results may vary, but that is how I weighed it out. We're not going to take a chance time to look. And in a minute, I have a handout for here, but I don't want to give it to you yet because there's another question I need you to answer, and the answer is on the slide. If I give it to you now, it will ruin the surprise. So we're going to get there. But you can take these home if you want to go back and look at these short letters and think about this yourself. Let's see. 1 John 5, 18, little children, let us love not in word or speech, but in truth or action. He gets a little bit on both sides of the equation on that one. You know, you can kind of go either way, but action is highlighted there. 2 John 1, 4-6. I was overjoyed to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as we have been commanded by the Father. But now, dear lady, I ask you, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but one we've had from the beginning, let us love one another. In the New Testament, the verb to walk is used metaphorically to talk about the way we live our lives. And so, you know, the verb actually means to walk. If I'm going to walk from here to there, that's the word you use. But then it gets used metaphorically to describe the way we follow Jesus, our Christian walk. But if we look back at 1 John 2:23, no one who denies the Son has the Father. Everyone who confesses the Son has the Father also. And there John is making a statement that Christianity is a matter of belief. And so John recognizes both sides. But due to the situation in his congregation, he comes out on whole more heavily on the behavior side. Now, you surprised me a little bit with the way you voted tonight, because if I had to guess a group of brethren, you would have weighted yourself toward the behavior side. I really expected it to be more heavily on the one side than the other. So
that's why we voted the way we did.
That's it. You outsmarted me. Is that what it is? Okay. Y'all are, I should give you more credit than I did there. Okay. Here's some background. So what we're going to do tonight is I'm going to set the stage for us, and then we're going to look at the first five verses of chapter 1. And we'll be lucky to get done in 35 minutes with that. But as I began to look at 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and just some things I've been thinking about a lot in general, I arrived at the question, how do we, and I mean we as a congregation, how do we give careful attention to spiritual formation in a culture that aims at our lower brainstem? Now, our lower brainstem, what happens in the lower parts of our brain? You know the higher part of your brain, what it controls, and the lower part, what it controls? Yes. That's right. The lower brain is what you have in common with your dog, or in our case, our cats. So it's fight or flight happens in the lower brain. Your higher brain is where you begin to think. And you know, studies have shown that when you are under high amounts of stress or you fear that you are in danger, that fight or flight instinct kicks in and blood gets pulled into your organs, and you actually physically lose the ability to think rationally, clearly. You're into that panic assessment kind of mode. So that's what our culture, I think, is really aiming at. So here's the question. Here's why I couldn't give you the handout quite yet. What is the first thing that 80% of Americans do upon waking up?
Turn the alarm off. Close.
Open their eyes.
Yes,
80% of Americans, the first thing they do in the morning is they check their phones. Then you go to the bathroom, maybe so. But do you take your phone with you, okay? Now that might be because you use your phone, Barbara, as your alarm. I do. And I set it across the room, so I have to get up, walk across around the bed to turn off the alarm. 80%, you know, you might find a survey that gives a little different number, but this is the survey that's 80% of us first check our phone. Now I can hand out the handouts. Give out the handouts here.
I only made 20 copies, so,
Lest you think like Mark Wilson, I didn't underestimate the attendance tonight. I was conserving paper when I only made 25 copies. So, I listen to a lot of podcasts along the way, and TED Radio Hour is one that I check out fairly frequently. And they have an October 13, 2017 broadcast with the title Manipulation. And I encourage you to take a look at it. If you have a source that you listen to podcasts or whatever on, this is a good one to listen to. Because it focuses very much on how social media is engineered to get us to come back, to make us addicted to it. And it's not by accident that these things happen. Social media research is designed to capture our attention. We think, or we might be inclined to think, that social media engagement is designed to help us engage issues, help us think more deeply, and build connections more widely. But it does very poorly at those three things. And yet, we live in a world where 80% of the people, the first thing that they do in the morning is check their phone. Our smartphones technology is totalizing. It's different from gossiping on the telephone. You can make the case that people have always been nosy and been involved in other people's business. But there's a difference between being in everybody else's business on Facebook and being in everybody else's business when you have, who here grew up with a party line phone? Okay, right? It's different. It's the same, and yet it's different. The way it captures, because you can never get away from it. You could at least hang up the phone. I did not grow up with a party line phone, but many of the people in my first congregation did. And by the time we lived in Patrick County, nobody had it anymore, of course. But you know, this is a place where in the wintertime, the roads around there in the Evelynsville community in Patrick County were dirt. You know, and so about the mailman was about the only person they said you'd see come through in the wintertime. So once you hung up the phone, there was nobody else to gossip with. But with social media, you can gossip 24/7. You can, and teachers will tell you that, you know, it used to be that there'd be a fist fight at school, and you know, the boys would do their thing, the girls would do their thing, and everybody would go home. And Allie's shaking her head. Now it's all night long. And so what do kids walk into school stirred up about that's been going on social media all night? So it's totalizing. Social, and it's interactive. Every time you click on a Facebook news item, whether it's, you know, the picture of me holding Phyllis Meadows' dog this afternoon, if you saw that or whatever, you are programming your Facebook feed to give you more of that. So if you pick right-wing or left-wing political sites, you're going to, by definition, by design, be getting more of those automatically. You are training the algorithm how to give you your news. And that is fundamentally different than other sorts of media revolutions. Interestingly enough, globally, there are more Facebook users than there are Christians. And there are more YouTube users than Muslims. So you start to think about how does the church engage, you know. You get us 1 hour, 2 hours on Sunday morning, 1 hour on Wednesday night. You know, it's when I do, you know, the daily, the devotional, the Bible readings that go along with our new members curriculum or the sermon series, that really the design is to kind of get a little more church, you know, consistently throughout the week, you know, thinking about these things. And so I'd say this is the issue that lies underneath other issues. Smartphone technology changes the way we engage with one another. And so I say all of this to you to ask a couple of questions. For again, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John are congregational letters. And so these are congregational questions. How do we express ourselves when we disagree, including a social media? And perhaps we need to think about a social media ethic for Oak Grove Church of the Brethren. How will we behave on social media? We don't often think about things like that, but I think we should. You know, what are my obligations to you when I get on Facebook? And what are your obligations to me? And does any of the sort of the continual turmoil of society, does it by default bleed over into our other relationships? And how do we guard against that? Where and how does social anger find an outlet? Are we going to have more Charlottesvilles, in the years going forward? What does the world look like? And what spiritual practices do we engage in the social media age? So how are we forming our souls to navigate turbulent times where we have all of the technology, in the universe, right here in our hips, and yet are losing the ability to be in deep relationship with one another? Going back to the question I asked at the beginning, what are the issues facing the church? These are three that I would put on the list. And these are all sort of fundamental underneath issues that we need to be thinking about as we work out other things. Anybody want to weigh in or disagree or offer correction or more info? Or
I see a lot of people expressing their anger on social media. Me personally, I ignore it and just refuse to look at it because I don't think you're addressing the public, not the person that you might have the issue with.
Right. It's there.
During the presidential election, every time I felt like saying something sharp, I decided to call my mom instead. I would stop the post, yeah, and I would call my mom. Finally, she said, "Son, you gotta quit calling me, son."
You know it's bad if your mom's getting tired of your phone. But you've highlighted to me something really important. You were self-aware enough to do something else. And I think that's a significant spiritual practice. And I'm not going to do this. Paul tells Timothy, flee from the evil desires of youth, right? And the word flee means literally flee. There's nothing metaphorical about it. Run in the opposite direction. That's a great example. So what do we do? And that's not obviously a question we can answer tonight. But when we open the hymnals on Sunday morning and lift our voices, are we thinking that I am counteracting the gunk of the world, by that action? We bow our heads in prayer. When we talk in the vestibule prior to church and we sit, you've made a decision tonight to come here and give me the privilege of talking to you about these things. I think we need to see our faith that way. It is increasingly important that we do so. Okay, so there's the introduction. Updated, this is in your handout. Here's how we're going to, with the extra week. It was really nice. I made it over here last Wednesday morning, and even though I did forget to put the things on the prayer chain that we weren't having church, I did at least have time to study 1st, 2nd, 3rd John a little more. And I found another path through it. And so tonight we're doing the introduction in the first five verses. Next week we're going to go through chapter 2, verse 2, which really gets the introduction to the letter. And then we're going to find out that John is really wrestling with the question, how do we faithfully follow Jesus in our times? And he comes up with what one biblical commentator calls a moral test, a social test, and a doctrinal test. And he talks about each of those three different times in his letter. And so rather than going through in order from chapter 1, verse 1, to chapter 5, verse whatever, we're going to jump around a little bit under those categories, the moral, social, and doctrinal tests. Then we'll take a break for Ash Wednesday, and then we'll come back on February 21, and we'll do the short, very short letters of 2 John and 3 John. The background to John's letters, they are not generic love one another letters. John had a reason for writing, a very clear reason for writing, and we will be taking a look at that. And he's arguing against a heresy. It would appear, and we have to read between the lines a little bit on some of this, but it would appear that there is another heretical group, that there are those who used to be part of this congregation who are putting forth ideas about Jesus that are fundamentally incorrect. and they are dangerously incorrect. There is a difference between being wrong and being a heretic. Being wrong is that you're incorrect. Being a heretic means you are actually holding a fundamental belief that cannot in any way be reconciled with the gospel. And that seems to be the case. It's a little hard to tell from John's letters what the issue was, but it would seem to be that these people denied the fullness of the incarnation, denied the mystery that Jesus was fully God and fully man. They then seem to have a moral indifference of those who claim to follow Jesus, that it didn't really matter what you do, didn't really matter how you behaved, so long as you claimed to believe. We haven't heard that in the news lately at all, have we? All right. Did I just go there? And third, enables an arrogant lovelessness of the people. So they're just people acting kind of hateful towards one another. Those seem to be this group that now has left the church. So there's been this division in the congregation, and the heretical group has left. John is now writing to as he describes, the faithful congregation who has remained. And he is instructing them on some matters of faith. So he has a reason for writing. John Stott, who is an excellent biblical scholar, says, John lays his emphasis on three marks of authentic Christianity, namely belief in Jesus as Christ come in the flesh, obedience to the commands of God, and brotherly love. If you read 1 John particularly, did you notice how often he tells us, love one another? Love one another. It's a great idea, but it was even more of an issue for John to make that point. John's letter is very pastoral. My little children, I am writing these things to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Right? We ask these questions in our worship a lot. Confession and repentance. Pretty fundamental parts of Christian worship. But it's also polemical. Now, do we know what the word polemical means? He has an agenda for writing. He's putting forward an argument that he wants to win. I write you these things concerning those who would deceive you. That's the difference between you being this heretical group that is out there. All right. Now we're ready for Bible study. All of that to get us to 1 John 1, 1 through 4. I've talked a lot. Would someone come up here with their Bible and read just those first four verses?
Or not.
Thank you.
1 through 4. Chapter 1, 1 through 4.
Okay.
Yeah, these people
need to hear. Great, okay. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have not seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared, we have seen it and testified to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete.
Okay, thank you.
What translation is
that? NIV. New International Version, NIV. Mm-hmm. I've had two people recently ask me for advice on a study Bible. And there's only like 500 options. Barnes and Noble. As you heard that, and maybe we need to read it again, and that would be fine. What were your first impressions on the point that John is making?
He was an eyewitness.
So I didn't talk about authorship, but are we clear that the author of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John is the same author as the Gospel of John? And there's also then one more book that John penned.
Revelation.
So he was an eyewitness. Why is that important? Okay, we'll start over here and then I'm going to come over here.
I said, what are your righteous truly if you saw it?
He saw it. Dolores? There's nothing better than an eyewitness. So that means he saw what? I mean, I'm belaboring the point here for a reason.
He saw Jesus.
Which means for us, on Christmas Eve, we're talking about a real person. And I don't know, maybe I'm just trying to really nail the obvious here. But we are heirs of a tradition that goes all the way back to a real person who made some pretty particular claims that these were eyewitness events. And I don't know if we think about that enough, you know, but maybe we do, maybe we don't. He's an eyewitness, which gives all of his opponents a problem, who maybe believe that Jesus was a man, but, you know, may not believe that he was God. You can't at least get around the point that you're dealing with somebody who walked with Jesus during these crucial events. He was an eyewitness. Okay, excellent point to start. Fundamental point here. What else does he describe it? How does he describe this, I would say? Or maybe let's read it again. Let's do that. Now listen again to how John describes his experience. We declare to you what was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. This life was revealed, and we have seen it and testified to it, and declare to you the eternal life that was with the Father and was revealed to us. We declare to you what we have seen and heard, so that you may have fellowship with us, and truly our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We are writing these things so that our joy may be complete. What else did you hear? As John sets the stage.
He wants to return to fellowship with those that have left. Have a different viewpoint.
He would love them to come back. Yeah, I think I'll leave it at that. I have another thought, but I think I'm going to leave it at that good point.
Mm-hmm. What he touched, what he learned, so that they can all be in fellowship.
Yeah, let me go to the next slide. If you count, John talks about hearing twice, seeing four times, touching once, and then the fact that he uses language of declaring these things five times, and that all of this was revealed to him. He didn't make it up. He's just reporting on what was made clear to him. But he's very sensory in these, right? I mean, he gets three of the five senses. He stopped short of saying he smelled Jesus, but it sounds like he might have. He's really hammering this point home that Jesus was really here. But then he says some other things about what was from the beginning. Well, where have we heard that language before? John. Yeah, you go back to the Gospel of John, and he takes the birth story. I mean, there's a reason why. We don't, when Martha leads this at the children's pageant, she doesn't use this from John's gospel, because we have to go all the way back to creation if we started the story with John, which I just gave away the other place we hear this language. Genesis. Right. What claim is John making about Jesus by going all the way back to the beginning? Jesus was God. He was with God in the beginning. Other New Testament writers have to say this. So you see, John is really being clear on this fundamental truth of the gospel that Jesus is fully God and fully man. The incarnation. If you ever had the chance to take a church history class, you get to wade through about the first two or three centuries of the church as the church worked this out against a Greek thought that downplayed the importance of the flesh. And so the idea that God would become flesh was almost unthinkable for Greeks, because they put such an emphasis on the divine, that why would God become flesh? And so it was a major point for Christianity then. I think this also then forces us to reckon with those who would say Jesus is just a great teacher. Because John is not saying that Jesus was a great teacher. John is saying Jesus was God, which is a whole lot more than just a great teacher. So it really allows the church to talk about the uniqueness of Jesus in our day and why we make the decisions that we do. Is there anything else you want to pull out? We're going to move on here to verse 5, and then we're going to stop. I might actually get us to choir one time. Carol won't know how to act. All right, so John is rooting his letter and his ethics and his admonition to his congregation in the reality of Jesus from the beginning with God revealed to us in the flesh. We then come to the heart of John's letter, verse 5. This is the message we have heard from him and declare to you: God is light. In him there is no darkness at all. Any hymns come to mind that talk about light? Shelley's already got one in her head. What is it? You don't have to sing it. Just say it. What? Do you have a hymn about light that came to mind? What's the name of it? You don't have to sing a solo.
Oh, This Little Light of Mine.
This Little Light of Mine, yes. This Little Light of Mine, I'm going to let it shine. Interestingly, who's the light in that song? This Little Light of Mine. We are the light. Yeah. That's which gospel writer says you were the light of the world? That's Matthew, Sermon on the Mount. We're going to come to look at that. Yeah, Sermon on the Mount. He looks at this ragtag group of people who have come to hear him preach that day, and he says, you are the light of the world. Now, John says, in John's gospel, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Matthew says, you are the light of the world. So, yes, this little light of mine. Are there any other hymns of light? I didn't think to look that up myself. If we had Carol in here, she'd probably just be, ticking them off. Light is a fundamental New Testament way. The contrast between light and darkness is a fundamental New Testament way to talk about the difference between those who are with God and those who are not. Those who are with God or following Jesus, depending on if you're right, the Old or the New Testament, would be said to be in the light. What happens when you're in the light? What are the benefits of being, just never mind the spiritual connection, physically, what are the benefits of being in the light? You can see, right? You can see. And if you're in the darkness, you can't, right? I mean, Dave Jones, how much time, Dave, have you spent over the last 6 months installing exterior lighting here at the church? Because some of you have said, it's a little dark. And we like clear lighting, not this year, but last year at the Christmas Eve service. I took the light from the Christ candle onto mine, and I got to the two steps to come down to give the light to Bill, and suddenly where there had been two steps, there were seven. And I thought, I'm going to fall down the stairs here on Christmas Eve, because the shadows were playing all kinds of tricks on me. I was prepared this year, but caught me by surprise. So walking in the light so that we can see clearly. Let's look at some scripture passages here. This is an important enough, that big enough font, by the way, in the back. You see that? Or not? Okay. Dave's not so sure. So we have three passages, Psalm 119, 1 Corinthians 4, 5, and Matthew 5. Somebody just want to claim each one of those and we'll read them. As you're looking those up, this is John's main point. He wants them to get this idea. Any debate about our personal character or the character of God, I'm going to flip back the screen just for a minute, begins and ends here. God is light, in him there is no darkness at all. And all of the implications for our living will grow out of this affirmation. Oh, Psalm 119 is going to give us another song about light. Just need two verses. Somebody have Psalm 119, then that's verses 105 and verse 130. You don't have to read them all, just those two.
I do 105.
Okay.
Thy word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path.
Ever sung that song before? Thy word is a light unto my feet and a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just want a couple of verses?
Just 130. Yeah, then verse 130. You don't need the whole thing. Just 119, verse 130. Psalm 119, verse 130.
The unfolding of your word gives light and gives understanding to the soul.
Now, the unfolding of your words gives light. So, reading, studying, understanding the truth of God's word gives light, sheds light on our living. 1 Corinthians 4, 5.
Therefore, judge nothing of before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's heart. Okay. At that time, each will receive his praise from God.
Okay. So Jesus will come. He will make things clear. He will shed light on our motives. That's interesting. That relieves a little pressure from us, doesn't it? We don't have to spend our time on social media telling everybody who we disagree with what a big idiot they are. God will make it all clear in the end. And we might find ourselves on certain issues on the other side of the evaluation. And then Matthew 5, 14 through 16.
You are the light of the world. The city on the hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand.
So do we know who Jesus is preaching to at the Sermon on the Mount? I don't want to turn this into a Bible study on the Sermon on the Mount tonight. That would be another excellent topic. But those verses come immediately after the Beatitudes. The poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, and those who for whom people revile and persecute and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. And there are some who will make the claim that Jesus spoke the Beatitudes the way he did because he was describing the crowd who had come to listen that day. And if that's your standard, they're not the movers and shakers in society. They're not terribly important people. They're people upon whom the world has put down and cast aside and this and that. And it is to those people that Jesus looks and says, you are the light of the world. So when we start talking about light, and as we move forward into John, and he starts talking about how we are to live faithfully in our times, then we can set aside any kind of competition with one another or one-upsmanship or claim of lack of skill or ability or anything else. Because if Jesus can look at kind of a ragtag group of people who have followed him out to hear him preach one day and say, you are the light of the world, then surely he can do something with me and with you and with all of us. So we'll take a look at that over the next couple weeks, how John talked about our behavior being such a vital piece of faithful Christian living. And we'll save the belief question for another season of Bible study. So, any questions? Anyone with the last word? 7:15, take note.